You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. The war in Ukraine has dragged on for 4 years, with Russia now occupying 20% of Ukraine. But it would be less inaccurate to call Russia's invasion a success based on data compiled by Seth Jones and Riley McCabe of CSIS. Despite Russia's control of information received by its citizens, you would think that the U.S. envoy, Steve Witkoff, could leverage this data to influence the trajectory of negotiations aimed at ending the war. Although we have recently removed sanctions from Russia, so right now they're all clapping, jumping up and down, party hats. But how badly did Vladimir Putin miscalculate his likelihood of a swift and clean victory? And how much has Ukraine shown a battle prowess that counters the Russian narrative of Ukraine's cultural inferiority? We asked Seth Jones, president of the Defense and Security Department and the Harold Brown Chair of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, to walk us through this extremely important set of findings. Had he not wandered into a restaurant, we might never have gotten him. But
that's not
true. I pegged him there eventually, right? When it was no longer relevant. Hey, they took sanctions off of Russia. That's it. The price of oil is spiked right now. He's feeling all comfy and amniotic, I think, Putin. What do you think?
I think something like that is probably true.
Well, I'm really glad you're here, but I did like this report. Obviously, you've written a lot of things. I mean, this was a pleasure and interesting. I frankly think anybody negotiating for the United States needs to read it and feel pretty good about negotiations, or at least at the time the report was drafted. I don't know about without sanctions. But the title is Russia's Grinding War, Massive Losses and Tiny Gains for a Declining Power. And we will hyperlink it in the notes to the cast. So how badly is the war going for Russia?
Well, it has not gone particularly well in several areas. And by the way, thanks for having me on. This is a great topic, great podcast, great discussion. So really honored to be on. I mean, I think the sort of $64,000 question is, how do you know how the Russians are doing? So we looked at a couple of different indicators. The first is, how are they doing in terms of casualties and fatalities? So that's one interesting indicator to look at. By the end of December, they were around 1.2 million casualties. They're closer to 1.3 million casualties today. That is an extraordinary number, and upwards of 325,000 killed in action. We can talk in a little bit more detail about how those compare to every major power, at least since World War II. I mean, the numbers are absolutely astounding. So one is they're dying and they're being wounded in historical numbers, at least over the last century or so. The second is, how fast are they moving? At current rates, the Russian forces have an average rate of between 15 and 70 meters per day in their most prominent offensives, slower than almost every major offensive campaign in any war over the last century. And that includes numbers during the Battle of the Somme during World War I, where the rates of advance were faster than that. In addition, we looked at other areas, you know, the strength of the Russian economy. And we can go into more details in a moment, but growth of 0.6% last year, zero Russian technology firms in the list of top 100 technology firms in the world, space program that is really colossal failures over the last couple of years. I mean, across the board, the Russians are really struggling. And, you know, hard for me to call them, really, they're not a major power, second order, maybe even a third order power right now. They're really a declining one, though, at this sort of end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think, what are they, the 11th largest economy, with California, the state alone, being the eighth or something? But let's talk about what these Russian casualties look like. Part of what I understand, and I welcome correction, is that a lot of the people who support the war are more rural, getting limited access to information. They tend to be more pro-Russia. Is it their children who are fighting this battle, or is it what we're hearing about foreign mercenaries, North Koreans, Africans?
Yeah, so there are a number of organizations that have been digging into Russian killed in particular, but also casualties. organizations like the BBC and MediaZona. What appears to be the case is that the vast majority of those Russian killed are not coming from some of the key politically important areas like Moscow or St. Petersburg. Instead, they're coming from areas of Russia like the Far East and the Caucasus. So these are populations that are traditionally poorer, that are ethnically diverse, that aren't typically of Russian ethnicity. And so, you know, in a sense, the Kremlin, particularly Vladimir Putin, clearly assesses that these individuals are expendable. So, yes, there are also others that have been let out of prison. There is a contingent of North Koreans. There's some militia forces. But the great irony is that most Russians from key areas that the Kremlin has to worry about are not the ones that are dying. But again, the casualty and fatality rates are astounding.
And you started to explain that this is epic in terms of the losses, that it's distinct from any other battle. Can we put a little bit more gloss on that? Because I noticed you had some facts and figures, like how does this compare to World War II, Korea, Vietnam, anything that we might automatically contextualize?
Let's start with fatalities. So Russian battlefield fatalities are somewhere in the area of upwards of 325,000 between February 2022, when the war begins, the full-scale invasion begins, up until right around now. So if we look at battlefield fatality numbers from the U.S., just as one example, the U.S. lost 54,000 in Korea, 47,000 during the Vietnam War, 149 during the Gulf War, which was a major conventional war against the Iraqis, 2,465 in Afghanistan during both Operation Enduring Freedom and then Freedom Sentinel, and then just over 4,000 in Iraq during Iraqi Freedom. So again, those numbers, 54,000 during Korea, 47,000 during Vietnam, and we're talking about 325,000 in Afghanistan. Even when you bring in Russian fatalities during Soviet wars, or even during the Russian campaign in Chechnya, Russian battlefield fatalities are 17 times larger than the number of fatalities that the Soviets suffered in Afghanistan over a decade, and 11 times greater than the combination of the first and second Chechen wars that the Russians fought in the 1990s and 2000s. And really, to add insult to injury for the Russians, what they have suffered in terms of fatalities in Ukraine is over five times greater than all Russian and Soviet wars combined since World War II. Really is extraordinary historically. And when we looked at fatality figures from all major powers since World War II, the Russians have suffered more fatalities than any major power in any war since 1945, which is stunning.
It is stunning. And then you also mentioned this sort of ridiculously slow advancement. You made reference to a World War I battle. I know there was a battle that at some point after years, they had only moved 2 kilometers. I assume that's what you're referencing. And, you know, they hardly needed to dig new trenches. It was so stagnant. You're comparing this, I believe, to that.
We are. I mean, the Battle of the Somme during World War I was extraordinary in the sort of bloodiness. It was the French and British advances in 1916, averaged about 80 meters per day during the campaign. And if you look at the Chasiv-Yar axis in Ukraine now, Russians have advanced, by our count, about 15 meters per day. Kupiansk, about 23 meters. Pokrovsk, about 70. All of these are slower than some of the slowest campaigns that we've seen in any war in over a century, because then we're pulling in World War I. And actually, one European ambassador said that they calculated for the Pokrovsk offensive that Russia has taken, if you started the Russians off the same day as a snail, once the Russians eventually took Pokrovsk, the snail would have beaten them to Pokrovsk, which gives one a sense of, we're talking about a snail's pace, literally, in the war.
You know, that's pretty remarkable, because I remember before this whole thing got started that the vice president wrote an op-ed piece in the Financial Times talking about why we wouldn't want to assist and how quickly Russia would dominate Ukraine, essentially basically saying we'd run out of material, we shouldn't get involved. Different topic. But I think it imagined a scenario so vastly different from what has played out that the whole assistance to Ukraine thing appeared more risky than maybe it has proven to be. But did you give me the monthly numbers? And then I guess secondary is, do the Russians know anything about these losses? Are they getting any information? Was that anything you guys unearthed?
Yeah, so starting off with monthly battlefield casualty losses, those are killed, wounded, and missing. It's over the last 2 years, the Russians were somewhere in the neighborhood of between really 35,000 a month to, in, say, December 2024, almost 50,000 a month. If you fast forward to 2025, in the neighborhood of the sort of bottom tier of casualties per month were about 28, 29,000. And then they were upwards of, like in January 2025, almost 50,000. So really anywhere between maybe 30 and almost 50,000 per month. And I think those numbers are kind of in the ballpark of where we are today, probably the lower end in the 30 to 35,000 casualties per month, but it's still pretty extraordinary.
I wonder, are they hearing anything about this? Did you look at whether or not they're getting information? Because, you know, the machine there is just notorious.
I mean, what they're getting from the government, the Kremlin in particular, first of all, it's not even a war. It's a special military operation. Second of all, no, they're not getting anywhere near what the truth is. In fact, when we put this report out, within 2 days, the Kremlin was asked at a press conference. And so the spokesperson for President Putin said that the only numbers that one could believe are those that were put out by the Russian Ministry of Defense. Now, I don't think the population certainly is getting these from Russian sources, state-run sources. If people have access to other sources of information, you know, some people have access to BBC and other sources, they can potentially see it. But remember, this is also a campaign where Vladimir Putin has argued that this is a war against NATO, not just Ukraine. And, you know, they have delegitimized the Ukrainian government. So that's the message since this war began. It's given false assessments of the causes of the war and certainly false assessments over the course of the war and how it is going.
Yeah. And I guess he's styled this as a war on NATO. And he's been railing against NATO for as long as he could get an international audience. But the first time I guess I became aware of it was that 2005, I guess, Munich Security Conference, where he went back to, you know, the Grand Duchy of fill in the blank, you know, this ancient history and about how everything had pushed forward. I mean, he's really great because he never forgets any injury inflicted, no matter how slight and no matter who against, and seems to surface that stuff publicly. So I guess that works for the Russian people. You know, the idea of a NATO encroachment must seem real. But I did think that that NATO expansion happened during Clinton and that he seemed to be particularly offended when it expanded into the former Warsaw Pact nations.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question that Vladimir Putin was particularly incensed, not just with the collapse of the Soviet Union itself, he was a KGB officer, but when the Clinton administration expands NATO. And so you get this sort of stunning development where countries that were not just Warsaw Pact members like Poland or East Germany, which reunifies with West Germany to become Germany, or Czechoslovakia, which obviously breaks out into Czechia and now and Slovakia, but also former Soviet republics like Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. They all become NATO members. The reality, of course, is that these are all democratic countries. They are choosing, understandably, I think, as any of us would choose, to come under the protection of the United States and its nuclear deterrent. And also, when you look at how societies, including economies, were faring in the East versus the West, I mean, of course you're going to choose the West. They were richer, they could choose their own leadership, they were generally happier. And so that's where they all wanted to go. And obviously, it was a development that was not in Vladimir Putin, probably the Kremlin's interest, but they lost.
Right. And now people have options besides law does, which, by the way, run forever, I've discovered, if you travel to Africa. So a couple things. It's great to talk about how bad they're doing, certainly, but obviously this is a battle between Ukraine and Russia. So how is Ukraine faring by comparison in terms of their losses and their ability to hold territory?
Obviously a great question. And, you know, the Russians, by the way, are doing some things well. They've become quite proficient at electronic warfare, their first-person view drones, and some of the cruise missiles that they have used have done extensive damage to Ukraine's energy sector. They're also really good at just overall at drones, and some of their drone units, like Rubicon, are superb. So, you know, the Russians, they have an advantage overall in recruitment numbers and mobilization potential and just the size of the military, size of their population. And that does put the Ukrainians at some disadvantages. So the Ukrainians are dying not quite in the same numbers as the Russians are. But if you look at sort of Ukrainian deaths, if the Russians are losing upwards of 325,000 fatalities, the Ukrainians are closer to somewhere between 100,000 and 140,000. If the Russians have total casualties of upwards of 1.2 and now 1.3 million casualties, the Ukrainians are somewhere in between 500 and 600,000 casualties by our estimates. And just two interesting things. The ratio then is about 2.5 or so to one. So for every 2.5 Russian soldiers killed and wounded, you get one Ukrainian. The other thing that's interesting is if you look at those numbers of casualties, combined Russian and Ukrainian casualties will likely reach, if the tempo continues the same, 2 million casualties by next month, which gives you a sense of kind of the extraordinary level of suffering that has gone on both sides, both the Russians and the Ukrainians.
Yeah, and maybe a podcast for another day, but I think sanctions relief and maybe a boost in the price of oil is going to advantage Russia. And I don't know how much of their drone capacity they derive from Iranian-produced hardware, or if any of that's going to go by the wayside during these attacks.
Just on that issue, the Russians were, in a sense, smart. So some of the Shahid production, the Shahid drone production, was the Iranians actually helped build facilities, including one around Yelabuga, Russia. So they essentially brought production facilities to Russia itself. So, you know, if Iran collapses entirely, they still have production facilities in Russia that the Iranians got going. So the Russians are now producing most of the drones by themselves. Now, they have relied on the Iranians for expertise. They have relied on the Chinese for components and some types of drones, including DJIs. And then, of course, they've relied on the North Koreans for artillery, some soldiers and others. So foreign countries, some of their allies, are important to all of this as well.
It's interesting. They have those kinds of allies with that kind of girth, and they're still showing this slow move and this level of fatalities. So why do you think they're doing so badly? Because they're doing badly.
Yeah. So a first-rate military, a successful one, really wants to conduct maneuver warfare. So, I mean, if you think about some examples like during the 1990-1991 Gulf War, where the Iraqis had invaded Kuwait, the U.S. builds up a force, coalition force in Saudi Arabia, and then moves pretty rapidly. And those tanks, you've got aircraft, including F-117 stealth aircraft, that are doing tank plinking. They're destroying tanks and other infrastructure in support of fast forward moving U.S. tanks. And so, you know, that's a good example of maneuver warfare. The U.S. is moving fast. It's actually moving on highways. Its air force and its ground forces, even its naval forces, are operating synchronously. There's combined arms operations. What the Russians are fighting right now is not a maneuver war. They're fighting attrition warfare. And some of the challenges that we have seen with the Russians in this war of attrition is that now they're moving so slowly that they can't actually use main battle tanks or infantry fighting vehicles to come close to the front lines. They've got to use dismounted infantry to wear down and attrit Ukrainian lines. Now, they're also using first-person or FPV drones and artillery and glide bombs and other kinds of standoff weapons. But just think for a moment of Russian soldiers that have to move on the ground through wooded areas where the Ukrainians are targeting them with their own drones and artillery barrages. In addition, those Russian forces are coming up against a Ukrainian defense in depth. So there are trenches. There's dragon's teeth. Those are anti-tank obstacles, generally pyramids, often of cement, which make it difficult for tanks to come in, mines, and other barriers that make it difficult to move even by dismounted infantry. And that's the reality. That's part of the reason which this is so slow. It's just basically on foot. I mean, they've lost the military initiative and they're moving on foot. And they're being targeted by a battlefield that is covered in tactical drones. The forces are being targeted. That gives one a sense, I think, for why the Russians, the pace has been so slow, is their officers got to get out of tanks and fighting vehicles, and they're on foot and obviously being identified and killed along the way. But the Russians are just sending more and more fighters through on these like kamikaze missions. That explains, I think, gruesomely, the problem that the Russians have. The Ukrainians have pulled off also some incredible operations, Operation Spider's Web, getting drones inside of Russia by Ukrainian intelligence, the SBU, and then targeting Russian strategic aircraft using Russia's own transportation system and telecommunications network was fascinating. More recently, we saw the Ukrainians based out of Libya conduct attacks against Russian shadow fleets in the Mediterranean. So they've been pretty innovative. A country, Ukraine, without a navy has largely taken out the Russian navy through uncrewed systems, both surface, also subsurface, and then air, including pushing the naval fleet out of Sevastopol in Crimea. And again, that's all without a navy. Sort of the innovation of the Ukrainians in all these areas has been pretty impressive.
You mentioned the term a war of attrition. That term is not used very frequently, modernly, and I want you to explain precisely what it does mean.
Yeah, so a war of attrition is one where the attacker attempts to wear down its opponent during a series of set piece battles, essentially through piecemeal destruction of its adversary. Those kinds of wars are characterized by sort of high casualties, a significant use of material, limited movements of front lines, and you would juxtapose attrition again to maneuver, where maneuver warfare is forces are moving with speed. I mean, just think even of the German Blitzkrieg through Belgium and the Netherlands and even France in the early stages of World War II, or some of the Israeli wars, or the 1990-91 Gulf War that we talked about. Actually, even 2003 Iraq, those are all maneuver warfare where there's a rapid movement of pieces. Attrition, again, is really a series of set piece battles where you're trying to wear down the adversary. And actually, that is one area where the Russians do have some advantages. The Ukrainians have a much smaller population, a much smaller pool of individuals to mobilize. So there are some advantages to being a bigger country. And if you're going to get into a war of attrition, you probably want to be on the side of the much larger population. It doesn't guarantee victory, as we have seen in Ukraine, but it does provide some benefits. Particularly if your population is not going to rise up against you, even despite high casualty rates.
Okay, that's sad and cynical because that means they've got more cannon fodder. They have more victims they can send to the front. What do you think has been the impact on Russia's economy? And I think today this conversation is especially important because as of our recording, sanctions on Russia have either been lifted or are going to be lifted, according to the president. And because of the attacks in Iran, the global price of oil has spiked. And the result of any increase in oil prices is a boon to the Russian economy because they are a petrostate. Is that right?
The Russian economy in some ways has done better than some people expected. Russia's trade balance remains largely in surplus. The ruble is not far off its pre-war valuation. And as you know, the country still relies to a great extent on its energy exports, particularly oil. Nevertheless, when you start peeling back the onion of the Russian economy, there are some huge problems. So let's look at a couple of things. Manufacturing has declined at its fastest rate since March 2022, with contractions in output and new orders. There have been multiple months consecutively of contraction of Russian manufacturing. If we look at economic growth in general, it was 0.6% in 2025. And according to the International Monetary Fund, it's still only going to be about 0.8% in 2026. That's obviously projected. But I think there are some other things which really bode ill for the Russians. The Russians face a capital problem. A country receives very limited foreign investment, and the country's essentially unable to borrow on international markets. What you see is an economy that essentially a war economy right now. It's focused on spending money on the armed services, the military industrial complex, some domestic security and debt service. And that's where most of Russia is spending its money. There's higher taxes. But if you look at things like GDP, nominal GDP, closer to Canada or Italy than certainly any of the major powers like the Chinese or the Americans or even Germany or Japan. And even if you look at purchasing power parity, the Russian economy pales in comparison. U.S. has a GDP that is five times larger, and the Chinese have an economy four times larger than the Russians. It's really a second or third tier economy. But I think the real problem that the Russians have is on things like productivity and innovation, really the engine of growth. I mean, look at AI, artificial intelligence. It wasn't that long ago that President Putin said artificial intelligence is the future, not only of Russia, but of all mankind. Whoever becomes the leader in this sphere will become the ruler of the world. That's the end quote. That's Putin. Well, if you look at Stanford University's rankings of countries based on what they call AI vibrancy, basically the capability of their AI ecosystem, Russia is almost dead last in countries with AI capabilities. The top performing Russian AI models are even older than the older generations of like OpenAI's ChatGPT or Google's Gemini. There are a couple other areas that are sort of interesting along these lines. Technology companies. You can go to the top 100 technology companies in the world. There are 60 companies from the United States in that top 100 list. None of them are going to be a surprise. NVIDIA, Apple, Alphabet or Google, Microsoft, Amazon. There are Chinese companies in there. There are Taiwanese ones like TSMC, Switzerland, Ireland, Australia. There are zero, let me repeat, zero Russian technology companies in the top 100. It is a damning statement of the failure of Russian technological prowess. And then you look at space, which the Russians were so famous for during the Cold War. Think of Sputnik. They are catastrophic in space. They've had a range of failed missions, including a big 2025 December major accident that caused severe damage at their launch pad. They barely got orbital launches out last year. And I think as you look overall, the Russian economy is hollow. Yes, it has oil and it's got some gas, but it is not productive. It's not really manufacturing outside of the military industrial complex. And I think what Vladimir Putin has done is he has essentially caused the productive collapse of the Russian economy.
But they'll never know that. That's the problem. I mean, I just don't think information gets in there, and it's always been a problem there. But that's fascinating and a sad commentary on autocracy and the consequences. Let's talk about, you mentioned that there's a wartime economy, a war economy. How'd you phrase it exactly? A war economy, right?
Yeah, war economy, I think, is probably
how do we get out of that? I mean, there's no analog, really, in the United States. I mean, we've certainly pivoted manufacturing to accommodate war efforts during the Second World War that I'm aware of, just because there's so much case law around that, and that's sort of the genesis of the Defense Production Act and the like. But what happens to a country like Russia if it's got this wartime economy that's being ginned up because of the conflict? What's the off-ramp here, and how do they maintain themselves? Do you see any of that being developed?
I mean, it puts them in a real bind. I mean, it means they're spending a lot on defense, and I would call it non-productive areas. You know, one thing that the Russians along these lines have tried to do is really import a range of what you might call high-priority items from the Chinese. And in fact, one interesting component of the Russian war economy is how much increasingly the Russians are relying on their relationship with China. Actually, if you look at oil exports and even gas exports, the Chinese have partially lost Venezuela. Iran has become very expensive and difficult to ship oil through the areas like the Strait of Hormuz. Russia is the one big area that the Chinese can rely on for oil imports. But it's the same thing for other areas of the economy, chips, because if you think of all of the areas, both military and civilian, that the Russians suddenly lost access to after sanctions were placed in March of 2022, they had to go elsewhere for it. I mean, there were some Western products that the Russians could get essentially re-exported through countries in areas like Central Asia. The Chinese have really stepped in and provided assistance, like even lithium batteries, fiber optic cables, and a range of other activity. China accounted for 70% of Russia's imports of a range of other products. And then just more broadly, Russia and China reached a trade deal in 2024, where you saw just huge increases of Chinese exports to Russia. China is Russia's top trading partner, period. Especially for areas like oil. So I think it's going to be a long haul for manufacturing productivity, particularly in emerging technology. I think Russia's economy really is going to hinge on energy. And that is sadly, you know, Russia will fall behind in technology like AI, just in technology and chips, because it's going to be importing. And it'll be a hollowed out economy there that will be saved because it's an energy rich country.
What about foreign investment? Is China invested other than just, you know, taking whatever's extractions? And I know, among other things, we should mention that, you know, Russia's a tremendous supplier of LNG, certain critical minerals, as well as, quite frankly, they have the capacity to enrich uranium. And I know we are customers of that. But what about foreign investment that might juice their economy? And included in that is the assumption that I often make that there's also such a thing as predatory foreign investment as a country like this increasingly depletes its resources.
Yeah, no, I mean, the problem right now, frankly, for foreign investment is there's not a lot of foreign investment in Russia, and the country has in general been unable to borrow on international markets. So how do you finance your war? You borrow at home, you raise taxes, and then obviously you make some money with energy exports. And that's sort of the reality of Russia, but not getting a lot of help on foreign investment, not getting a lot of help on international markets.
Let's talk about sort of the downstream consequences. I mean, it always seemed to me years ago that Russia was a pretty fragile place and that at some point it would be a full failed state. And we haven't really seen it come to that. But what are the downstream consequences to the rest of Russian society? Because, you know, we talk about Russia, we talk about Iran. There's always a sense from the experts that we speak to that when citizens really grow tired and get enough information, that this current government structure and leadership will stop because they won't be able to persist. But what about their institutions? How are they going to survive this?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. You know, there are regimes. Look at the North Koreans. Look at the Iranians that have persisted despite sanctions, despite economies in many ways that have struggled partly because of that. I think the reality is the Russians, for now, the Kremlin in particular, has figured out a way to lock down its society, control as much as possible the internet, threaten and follow through on individuals that have been in Russia and protested the war, not the military operation, the war, and cracked down on any dissent, killed a lot of the opposition. You know, it is amazing when one looks at opposition in Russia, even those elements like Navalny that have spent time outside of Russia, we see them die deaths like poisoning. Or some of my favorite Russian deaths are the opposition individual who accidentally falls off the roof of his or her apartment while moving a bathtub that lands on top of them. I mean, you can read between the lines as to what
They
happened.
fall out of hospital beds too, because
Yes.
apparently the hospital beds are next to the windows.
Yes. So, but I mean, that's the reality. And I think in that sense, the Kremlin and its security apparatus, including the FSB, has really cracked down on dissent. So what it's allowed the country to do is lie to its own population. It's allowed the country to suffer extraordinarily in the war in Ukraine, have its economy hollowed out, yet not face large-scale, certainly violent opposition. You know, we certainly see that President Putin is in power and continues to conduct an aggressive disinformation campaign within his own country, and actually some of which has actually been bought hook, line, and sinker by Western officials, including some US officials.
Yeah, query why? Because I look at your report and I see sort of raw data that means we would have the upper hand in any negotiations, and that ultimately they have to understand that this thing is not working the way they're claiming, and the truth will out. Yet we seem to approach this as if they're winning. I don't quite understand that. I'm sure we both have theories on that. But tell me what your big picture takeaways were from doing this. I wondered where you imagine this thing would end. And I know you're not commissioned to be a prognosticator, at least not here, because you're not doing battlefield analysis, as I know you have done in very dangerous circumstances. But if you're looking at this, how does this thing end? And maybe what are some potential tipping points in your view?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I would say the Russians are not doing anywhere near as well as they say they are, or as some people believe. They're historically slow levels of advance, slow levels of territory and limited areas of territory that they've conquered, and also extraordinary casualties and fatalities that they've suffered. So this is a, by any assessment, the Russians are failing in conducting effective military operations in Ukraine. This is not a first world military, maybe second, could be a third world military. And I think the same as we've talked about, I would say economic and technological power, it's a second rate, maybe third rate in general. What that means, and this is a sort of a second big takeaway that flows from that, is that the Russians are vulnerable. So as part of negotiations, if one's goal is really to try to end this war, then, you know, both sides are going to have to cut some deals, make some sacrifices. But the Russians have been dragging their feet, and they are vulnerable if the US, particularly the President of the United States, decides to turn up the heat on the Russian economy and increase sanctions, including secondary sanctions, support more effective actions against the Russian shadow fleet. So this is the series of surface vessels, boats used to circumvent Western sanctions on Russian oil illegally transported by sea. And they typically sail under the flags of other countries like Gabon or Liberia or the Marshall Islands or Panama. And there's actually bipartisan support, even from friends of the president, like South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. So you could really go after increased sanctions, secondary sanctions, you could add minerals, metals, agricultural goods, fertilizer, and I think do some damage. Second, you could increase support and, you know, weapons supplies to the Ukrainians. drone components, particularly for long range. You could give them long range strike. They've been asking for medium and long range missiles. You could provide more air defense systems for protection around cities like Kyiv, whether it's Patriots or THAAD or others. Obviously, they're being used in places like the Gulf right now and in Israel. But the Russians are dying in extraordinary numbers in those aid packages. The way this works now is the US sends weapons or can send weapons. The Europeans buy them. So not US isn't giving them. The Europeans are buying them through what's called a prioritized Ukraine requirement list. And then the Europeans give them to Ukraine. So various types of material, equipment, and then munitions. So what you could do is the Russians continue to drag their feet, not just threaten, but then sanction them. And you're going to get that through the House and the Senate. And then you could give them aid, which there is also bipartisan support for. Give the Ukrainians aid with European partners. And that is really not being done in an effective way. So I think the easiest way to end this war is not being done. So it's frustrating.
Yeah, and you're not the only person saying that. It is true that I think a lot of people feel like this needs to be approached differently, although you highlight some very precise ways in which that could occur. Well, I hope it does end badly for Russia and soon. I just wonder how much the recent attack on Iran is going to create a diversion one and maybe ultimately inure to their benefit because of the oil prices going up.
It may be a wash. It certainly will be helpful for now on energy. But I mean, with the struggles of Iran, the Russians have lost a major partner, at least for now. They lost that a little bit with the Venezuelans, who they'd provided assistance to. They've lost it with Syria when the Assad government was overthrown. So the Russians have actually lost a lot of friends in the last year, two, or three. So, the war in Iran also is going to be a downside. And if there was any hope of getting Iranian exports of Shahed drones or other equipment, well, that's not going to happen. So, there are also some big downsides with Iran being in the position it's in right now.
Well, I hope that's right, because I would really like to see that war end. It's really awful, but it's also sad to think of Ukraine being carved up in the way that it may be in order to achieve some sort of resolution. It seems awarding the aggressor unnecessarily, in my view. Well, I'm always glad to talk to you. This was a good report. We'll go ahead and hyperlink that report in the notes to this cast so you can get right to it. There's also a video cast that I think features Seth and his co-author, Riley, which we will also hyperlink in case you want to take a look at that, maybe while you're at the gym or wherever you may be. Anyway, I'm always glad to see you. And I look forward to whatever is the next thing that you pump out, which I'm hoping will have something to do with Iran, so you can educate me. I think it would be great to do that. Why, is it almost done? Are you almost finished with
No,
it?
no. I think we're gonna have to meet at a restaurant so I can hand deliver it to you.
That would be great because there's no way to get you on this podcast unless I interrupt your dinner, I have learned. Or I stand between you and your dinner, I think literally is what I think happened.
That is
Anyway,
what
I'm glad to see you. Thanks for coming in.
All right, thanks.
All right, thank you for listening to National Security Law today. We really appreciate you listening, but of course, we live in a world of technology and algorithms, so we want you to subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or whatever is your listening app of choice. Obviously, this amplifies our content. We believe in civil discourse and education as opposed to screaming. Screaming gets rewarded, so find a way to reward us. I just want to thank everybody who helps us on this podcast because there are some very amazing people, in particular, my co-producer, the lovely and tireless Holly McMahon, our very lovely editor, Frances Burkham, our wonderful program manager, Antasia Hawkins Blakeney. And we do get social media and occasional research support from Alana Coopersmith. But really, what we get is a lot of input from the brilliant people that compose the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. These are some of the best minds in Washington, and they do participate in this and give us great ideas because they do pursue the good without any interest in politics. So thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week.
The views expressed on National Security Law today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.